And I've always told people this. My show isn't a destination show. Cirque du Soleil is a destination show. Rod Stewart's a destination show. Celine Dion's a destination show. Blue Man Group's a destination show. We booked a trip, we booked a hotel, and we're seeing this show. That's why we're going, because we've always wanted to see this show. Then you have 3 extra days here. And then I'm the show that people go to see, going, hey, we got a Sunday, nothing to do. Let's go check out Murray, the guy in Pawn Stars. That'll be fun. So I'm a show after you get here as an afterthought. And I'm okay with that.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Celebrity magician Murray Sawchuk just finished a 2.5-year run at the Tropicana's Laugh Factory in Las Vegas. But not to let grass grow under his feet, Murray has just signed a contract with Caesars Entertainment Properties to perform afternoon shows at the Sin City Theater in Planet Hollywood starting December 20th, 2014. Learn how Murray made the transition, plus how he got started, and why he has the reputation as a celebrity magician, plus lots of advice on being a successful performer on this episode of The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for TheMagicWordPodcast.com, and that is my guest this morning, and I do mean morning, Murray Sawchuk. Hey, good morning, man.
Hey, how you doing, Scott? Glad to be talking to you.
And with you as well. Your hair must be a mess this time of the morning. Oh, wait a minute.
It's a total disaster, morning, noon, and night.
But I was going to say, what's the difference between, in the morning, how do you fix your hair?
Exactly. It's probably better in the morning.
You just kind of run your hands through it or something and say, hey, I'm good.
Exactly. That's about it. Hands, quick comb. And
now, do you use anything like, I remember when I was in college, there was a guy who had like a spike haircut, and he would use Coca-Cola because of the sugar or something, pure cane sugar or something in there. It would make it just stand stiff, like that. Sure. Do you use a special kind of hairspray or something?
I just use, there's a couple of hairsprays I use as Trace to Me, which is the cheap stuff because I go through it like crazy.
Oh,
and
man.
Then also the other stuff is like an H2 Extreme. It's this yellow can that you always see at Walgreens or CVS. So if I'm doing a TV show, it's funny you ask, but if I'm doing a TV show all day or I'm doing a long shoot or something, I'll use that stuff. Otherwise, I'll just use regular stuff because with me coloring my hair and styling it all the time, it's like, you got to condition it all the time. So it's funny, I get asked that a lot, but really, it's one of those things where it's probably, Coke's probably better for it because it'll wash right out easier than,
all the hairspray.
Alcohol-based, hairsprays.
It's funny, I was working with Ted and Marion Outerbridge, probably good friends of yours also from Canada, this past summer with the Colons Abbott's get-together, and I was wanting to use some hairspray, and Marion said, hey, you need to use this stuff. It will hold like concrete. This is supposed to be fantastic stuff, and it was. You could almost knock like wood on there. It was just some, I don't remember what it was, but man, it took a
while
to wash it out, but it lasts.
Well, there's this hairspray you can buy from a salon. I remember a funny story. When I used to comb my hair nice, I used to comb it to the side, feather it in the back, and wore a black tuxedo, red bow tie in our standard days.
Sure.
And I must have been, 16 or 17. And, of course, it was windy. I was doing an outdoor show at a mall in my hometown of Vancouver, Canada. And it was funny. One of the girls, I need to borrow her hairspray. And I always would, because my hair was never really that thick. I'd have to back comb it like I do now to make it look thick. So what I'd do is I would actually put hairspray in, dry it, then comb it out so it'd fluff the sides a bit, and then same with the top. Well, the hairspray she gave me was this Joico stuff, ice mist. Well, this Joico ice mist is literally one step away from cement. You could actually build a home with it. And I didn't know this. So I'm backstage, with a little mirror and a plastic kind of makeshift dressing room on this wooden stage they built. So I spray this stuff in, blow dry quickly, and I go to literally comb it back, and I combed it back, and the comb got stuck in my hair. It actually got wrapped around in my hair, and I'm here at a venue, and I got to go on stage in literally 10 minutes with a comb stuck in my hair. Not even. It's one of those combs that were like 360 that the girls used because I had four hers.
Yeah.
So I spun the thing, and the whole damn thing got stuck in the side of my head. So there you go.
So you did a show with this brush stuck in your hair.
Exactly. And what's funny is now rappers wear these combs in their hair, and see how trendy I was back then?
Well, that's what I was just about to say. What's his name on late night? It was on Jimmy Fallon's show. Q, what's his name? Where's that pick in his
head? That's right. Became this real trend. So, I was way ahead of the time there, Scott.
Yes, you are. Speaking of that, I was going to ask you about trends in the future. Maybe this The question I was going to save until later, but while we're on the subject, that is that a style? Obviously, you know, when people think of Murray and the hair, you know, it's just like, you know, Sally Jesse Raphael had, boy, I'm dating myself there, red glasses, you know, or
That's
something.
That's right. You're right. I remember her for years. She was on TV for like 20 years.
Sure. But there are certain things that will be a person's thing that they will remember. And as people get older, they try to, you know, keep a same look, but sometimes it looks like you're just trying to do that. You're trying to keep, you won't let go of the past. I mean, is there something that in the future, let's say, you know, what I'm wondering is like, you know, what Murray Sawchuk will look like, you know, at age 60, you know?
I think a lot of people are wondering that. Probably the same thing. One thing I'm kind of looking forward to is when I get older, I think I'd love to let my hair go like grayish white. I think it would look really cool. I love the peppered look. I think George Clooney looks great in it. Richard Greer looks great in it. A lot of people do. And I think even Roseanne Barr's now let her hair go kind of this grayish, black-gray kind of thing. It looks really cool on her because I know she's one of the judges on Last Comic Standing now.
Right.
And it's kind of a cool look when you get older. So I think more likely, you know, in my 50s and 60s, I'll probably still have – hopefully I'll have hair. And that will be more of a gray pepper kind of look, which I think – probably go with the style.
You know, I was just watching a video by Teller that was featuring, it was on YouTube, it was featuring Johnny Thompson. It showed him without his hair, putting on his toupee and combing it over and everything, you know. So he's still kept that look, but he's had to add that. You know, I hate to think that, you know, at some age that you're going to be having to stick this thing on top of your head, you know, that's...
The nice thing is with my hairstyle, I literally can go to Home Depot, cut the end of a broom off, and just glue it on. So I'm lucky. So it'll be a cheap way.
Yeah, and if you keep working out, you'll continue to be as thin as a broom, you know. And
exactly.
With that washboard stomach of yours.
Or... Exactly. Tell me about it.
That's got to be something, by the way, it's hard to keep up with. You know, I walk every day. I try to, you know, keep active as well. But I think that, you know, it particularly being, as you are known as a celebrity magician, of, you know, people don't want to see overweight people. And so I think that would be, you know, something kind of hard. Do you have a special diet? I mean, do you, aside from working out daily, or what's your regimen?
It's funny. It's this right here. I drink coffee till about 4 in the afternoon. Not even kidding. I love coffee. That's my only thing that I really probably drink more of or eat more of than I should. And I usually have one big meal a day, and then I snack. You know, like when I go out, if I'm driving somewhere, say I'm driving from here to L.A., which I do once or twice a week, I'll stop at a gas station, grab either a bag of carrots or, you know, even a small bag of chips or something, but it's all about moderation. Mm-hmm. So and when I go out and eat, you know, it's amazing. I love eating in Europe or even Asia, because when you eat over there, it's a plate of food that's just enough to fill you, and you really enjoy your meal. Whereas over here, you go to the Cheesecake Factory or you go to whichever your choice of food is, you know, even if it's fast food or in between, like Applebee's or Chili's or wherever you want to go, the meals are massive. Mm-hmm. And I think people also feel that they should finish their food. It's like the old saying when you're a kid, you know, don't, you know, leave the table until you finish your food. And unfortunately, I think in that mentality, you have a tendency to gain weight, you know, and I eat to get full. I mean, most of the time I'll only eat half my meal. And it's not because I'm worried about my weight. It's that I'm full. You know, I just don't want to eat anymore. So it's one of those things that's a catch-22, but I think everything's moderation. You know, I go on TV a lot, and I see myself on TV, and there's certain things, like Phyllis Diller, I remember listening to her talks. I'm a huge fan of hers, and she started getting her facelifts when she was in her late 40s and 50s. But she remembers seeing herself on TV when she was starting to get really popular, and she's like, oh my God, I look like an old hag. You know, and what's funny is that was always her angle, you know, but realistically she was a very beautiful woman. Mm-hmm. So she started doing stuff to create that character who she is now, to look more and more like what she thought she wanted and would like people to see her as. Same with Liberace and all these people. So you kind of, you know, I mean, obviously I got the hair and the glasses on now, but, you know, I'm going out to decorate a Christmas tree today for Opportunity Village here in Vegas. And and it's going to be outside. It's a magical forest thing. And I'll throw on a hat, my other glasses, just because, you know, most of the time when I'm at home, you know, I'm no different than you or anybody else. I'll throw on the ripped jeans and a hat and away I go, you know.
Right. Right. Yeah. And speaking of glasses, that's kind of another signature trademark. I mean, I guess you're not going to be having LASIK surgery or anything. Even if you do, you still wear glasses.
Yeah, and I need them. I get asked that question probably, you know, twice a week. Are the glasses part of the gimmick? Do you really need them? And I really did. You know, when I lived in Orlando, Florida, my optometrist, she was a very dear friend of mine, and I was wearing regular glasses. And she had, you know, when you're in that business, you get a lot of frames in to try, you know, from vendors. And so she had a box full of frames. Anytime you want a frame, it doesn't cost you anything. Just let us know. Pick some frames, you know, and get some, you know, get the lenses sent. We'll pay for the lenses, and you'll have your own, you know, you'll have your own glasses. So basically, she put these kind of glasses out for me. She said, I think you might look good, that Andy Warhol look. And that's kind of how it happened.
Yeah.
So I thought, what the hell, why not? So,
yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Somebody else woke up with me.
Oh, I see. you and Chloe have a dog. I see the dog on your Facebook page. I'm sorry, I shouldn't know. Her name?
Yes, it's Kahlua. And then we have another one that's black and white, Abby, but she's lazy, so she's still sleeping. But this one's up.
Because, yeah, it's like 7:30 out there on Vegas time. How many hours sleeping? I saw you posted something last evening on Facebook. I mean, it was like just a few hours ago, it seems like. How many hours a night do you sleep?
I think I probably go to sleep, you know, I used to sleep in all the time. I used to love my mornings. And I probably sleep 5 or 6 hours an evening. But I go to bed probably 1 or 2 because my wife works late in her show.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll sit up or have a drink and catch up and then go to bed. Or sometimes I go to bed early like this, you know, like last night. I did kind of go to bed early, about 1:30 in the morning for me. And then later tonight we're driving to L.A. because I'm shooting an episode of Hallmark's Home and Family tomorrow morning in L.A. But once again, I realize now because I got so much to do, it's easier doing an interview like this at 7:30 in the morning, start my day, and I just get a lot more done. You know, and if you know me, I'm always one. Once I say something, I do it. And you know, it takes an hour of your day, and once I'm awake, I'm awake. You know, so.
Yeah, no, that's true. And that's some people, well, I agree. I love my mornings, and I can sleep a lot. And I don't know. I think probably 12 hours is too much, but 11 hours is enough, you know, for me. If necessary, I can lay there for a while, you know, and I'm not just laying there. I'm asleep. But I know some guys, I remember talking to Coach Jakimla, it seems like that he sleeps like 4 or 5 hours or something. I know that a lot of guys like you and others who just, they're just not enough hours in the day, because once I get up, I'm kind of the same way. It's like when I get up, I am like a rocket out of a cannon or something. You know, you got to keep moving. And I know that you got just a lot of things that are always lined up and things, you know, you have a lot of balls you're juggling. You're able to catch all these as well. So, you know, how far in advance do you plan your activities?
It varies, you know, and before I go to bed every night, I write a list of what I do have to do in the morning. And I'm old-fashioned. I actually write a list. I mean, a lot of people put their things, phones and that, and I've never gotten used to that. I remember back in the day when I was in high school, dating myself as well, but before cell phones, you know, but they had these little flip kind of computer things so you could type your daily thing in, and I forget exactly.
Oh, Palm Pilots.
That's it, Palm Pilots and all that stuff, and you can draw things. And I never got used to it because whenever I'm a visual person, so I like to see a list, and then I love crossing stuff off a list. And it's not an obsessive compulsive thing. It's just something before I go to bed, once if I can see it, going, okay, in the morning I got to go here, I got to do that, then I don't forget it because obviously I see it and I write it down. But in a phone or an electronic device, if I forget to type it in or something, then it won't happen, you know. But when I can actually write it down and see it right away, it's much easier for me. So, you know, things are planned sometimes weeks ahead or months ahead. Like, you know, in a week and a half, I'm going to Vancouver, Canada to do a couple of shows, 3 shows up there. I'm driving up there with my equipment. My wife's flying up there just because I'm bringing my dog with me and my stagehand, Lefty, he's driving with me. And I love driving everywhere I go. If I have to, I just enjoy it. And if the weather's not that bad. And plus, it sometimes it does save a lot of money on cargo shipping, especially when you're doing only one date versus 3 or 5 or 10 dates. So yeah, we're doing that in a couple of weeks. But this TV show came up about a week ago. So literally, I changed my schedule. Cancel a few things, moved a few dates around, and then tonight we're hopping in the car, buzzing into LA, which is a 4-hour drive, and then we'll film all day tomorrow on set at Universal Studios. And it'll be airing Thursday morning, on Hallmark's Home and Family, which is a daily morning show on Hallmark, from, I think it's 10 to noon or something like that, or 8 to 10, depending what area you are in the States.
Are you going to be having a speaking part, or is it something about you, or is it a feature, or do you just have, what is it?
Yeah, I go on the show, and this is probably my 14th or 16th episode on the show. And it's a morning show. It's like any morning show, like the Today Show.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So it's a 2-hour morning show with Mark and Christina, and I go on and talk about what's new. So I'm obviously going to be breaking the news nationally about my move to the new hotel, Planet Hollywood, here in Vegas, and a bunch of stuff, and a couple of this new series I'm going to be on coming up, which you may have heard of on Reels channel, this new show called Extreme Escapes. And it's starting airing November 29th, which is one of Gabe Blackstone's productions. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about. I'm glad we got some time to visit about this because you're such a busy guy. But I want to go back just a second when you're talking about writing down a to-do list. I do that as well. Do you complement that with using a Google Calendar or something as well? Or do you,
I don't. You know, the only time I use calendars is whenever I do conference calls with somebody. You know, they'll send an email with conference call, and I'll click on, say, yes, 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 and they'll get an email, you know, half an hour before it or something, and that's because it's on their end. But for me, I've always had things written down, and I still to this day have, you know. And it's funny because my wife used to put stuff in her phone all the time, you know, because she's a lot younger and she's, you know, likes doing it that way. And then she lost her phone a few times, or it's actually frozen and you can't get into it. And once again, when you have a piece of paper with, you know, it written down, it never freezes up on you. It's right there.
That's a good point. So, that's what Nick, my son, always said too, that he has a pad of paper. It's like, you know, this computer won't get lost. I mean, it won't, you know, crash or anything. It, you know, but what I was going to say, I agree as far as writing down things. I have a notepad and pencil beside my, on my bedstand. So then whenever wake up in the morning, and before I put my feet on the ground, I'm thinking about, you know, well, what do I have to do today? Oh yeah, I almost forgot about this, and then I'll jot these things down. I put a little box. I'll actually draw a box, so that way during the day when I take that to my office upstairs, then I will just, you know, check it off. Yes, I did that, or, you know, this is still something I have yet to do. It's going to take a little bit longer or whatever, you know. But there are some immediate things that certainly need to get done by certain times, and that makes sure. So I agree. I think that that's good advice of having something that you can physically see. It's kind of like having some sort of a mantra that you've heard before, that you have pasted to your mirror or something to remind you, you know, every day, or to certainly have your goals written down rather than just thinking about them. I think if they're written, that you're more apt to achieve them, you know.
Oh, definitely, and I feel like you can achieve them. You can see where you're at in the day, and I'll even write down times sometimes, idealistically, when I can do them, you know. And that way, you know, I'll take it in the car, and then if there's anything else, I pick up dry cleaning or whatever it is, I'll write that in between stuff. And when you check things off, you feel like you're achieving things within the day, you know. So,
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to call you and talk to you straight away over here, I thought it was interesting. I just heard yesterday when it was officially announced here about coming up with at the at Planet Hollywood, and that's exciting. First of all, before I begin the conversation, first thing I was going to say to you are two things. First of all, congratulations on the 2.5-year run at the Tropicana. It's fantastic. And then also congratulations on the smooth transition into the Planet Hollywood. So I want to talk about both of those. Which would you like to address first?
Whatever you'd like. We can talk about Tropicana if you'd like, for
sure. Let's talk about that. That'd be kind of interesting to kind of see the transition, I guess, and how you begin with that and how that you had approached the Tropicana, or did they come to you, or, you know, how I'm sure things just don't necessarily always fall in someone's lap. I love stories like that whenever they do, but how did that actually come about?
Yeah, you know, long story short is I was shooting a TV series called The Jada Grace Show, and it was like a Hannah Montana type show with a young girl named Jada Grace, and she was on a few of the movies, like the Terminator movies, one of them. She was a little girl that was in the whole movie, and she's, you know, she's a singer, she's an actress. So the producers of that were shooting it in Vegas, and the guy owns the big studios here, which used to be called CMX Studios. Michael Jackson did some videos in there and a bunch of videos. But now it's called, I think, Las Vegas Studio City Studio, something like that, from Studio City Hollywood, you know. And basically, they were looking for a magic-type character for the kids to, almost like, you know, the guy on Tool Time who's behind the fence that you never see his face.
Never see his face, yeah.
Yes, they were looking at a person like that, not that same don't-see-him thing, but that voice of reason for the show, you know. So I was always in my workshop working on new magic tricks, and all the kids and that would always come to me for the voice of reason, almost, you know, good, bad, indifferent, or if they were in trouble. And then I always do a trick in the show. So it was good. We did a 13 episode series. I was in 7 or 8 of the episodes. The guys took a real liking to me. There was a guy named Harry Basil and a guy named Joseph Merhe, who basically were the executive producers. Joseph Merhe owned the studios and also owned the TV show. And then they have become friends, well, they've always been friends with Jamie Masada. He owns the Laugh Factory in L.A., in Hollywood, on Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
And they wanted to bring the Laugh Factory to Las Vegas. So they made a business deal, and basically Jamie Masada gave him the blessing to use the logo and the name and open a Laugh Factory at the Tropicana Hotel.
So he didn't actually own the one at the Tropicana. He just leased the name.
Well, no, they all, Jamie Masada owns all of them, but basically he was, it's almost like he franchised it, but he never left it. He didn't really franchise it. He just went in partnership with two other guys, Joseph Merhey, who was the money guy, and then Harry Basil, who was a comedian and the general manager of the club. So it was really owned by three people.
Gotcha.
But Jamie owns all of them. It's never been a franchise brand, but he still owns all of those, like Bud Freeman and the Improv and all those other guys.
Oh, okay. There you go. Got it.
So their Improvs are all over the place, but Bud still has an attachment, even though you may put some money in our eye. He still owns them.
Mm-hmm.
So they called me. I was performing at the Vegas Magic Theater with Paul Stone is producing it over at the Gold Coast, about a six-month run of, you know, like a magic castle kind of palace show there with three magicians every week.
Yeah.
They snuck in to see me perform there. They've seen my work lots, and Harry Basil pulls me aside and says, "Hey, Mer, I'm thinking about moving over to the Trop. Would you be able to do an afternoon show, kind of like Matt King-esque? We'd love to, you know, have your show in the Laugh Factory." So I said, "Well, let's look at the theater." So a week or two later, once they signed the papers, we went up there. Now, remember, I've never met Jamie Masada before. I've tried to meet that man for years, especially when I was doing open mics in L.A. I'm sitting in the room with Lefty, Doug, who's my best friend, along with as my guest act. We walk in, and that day it was funny. I was going to wear my hat, regular glasses and nothing, just because I know Jamie and Joseph. They're dear friends of mine. We filmed for, you know, 3 months together.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, I should maybe just comb the hair up and throw the glasses on, because you never know who you're going to meet.
Right.
And I thought I was just going to see the room, you know, kind of, okay, maybe it might work or it might not work, because it's a very small comedy club stage. So we get in there. I brought a press kit tonight, as I usually do, because I didn't know if I was meeting Tropicana people or what. And we are standing outside the doors. Joseph comes up to me. I know him, of course. Harry comes up. And then right behind them comes up this little shorter guy, skinny guy, black hair, really well combed, with an accent. And I said, "I wonder who that is." And, of course, don't forget, I've never met Jamie before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Jamie Masada, the owner of the Laugh Factory. And I mean, you know, if he likes you, he likes you. And if he doesn't, then he doesn't. And that's the way it works. He's the boss.
Right.
And so I was like, "My God, finally I'm meeting the guy." And I'm like, "Thank God." I combed the hair, shaved the face, put the glasses on. So we go in to sit in this theater, and we're literally sitting there. And it's Jamie, and it's Joseph, and it's Harry, which are the three guys who own the club. And it's Doug, Lefty, and myself. And we're sitting in the theater looking at this, and we're talking. And Jamie says, "All right, so I'm going to do my show. I'm going to have a show here." He says, "Why you? Why? How are we going to sell tickets to you? Like, what makes you so great?" I was like, "Holy crow, I didn't expect this." I mean, I think now I'm dancing. Now I'm auditioning for my job. And I thought I was just
looking at the theater.
So, yeah.
It was already a done deal, but yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, they were interested. The guys knew me. Jamie, I'd never met before. I thought, "Holy crow." So now I realize I go into, you know, trying to get a job mode again. And I start pitching myself, and I tell them what I've done on TV and my history of America's Got Talent and now Pawn Stars and the publicity that I do in the press. And so literally after about 33, 34 minutes, he's sitting there. And Doug's sitting, Lefty's sitting to my right. He looks at my press kit and all the other stuff I gave him. Looks at Joseph, looks at Jamie, says, "Look, it's nice. You've got some good stuff. I can see you're professional. You've done a lot. I know you. I've seen you on TV. You know, a lot of my staff watch you on Pawn Stars. So look, if these guys like you, I like you. We're all family. So great. Congratulations." So I got another meeting. I got to run. And he walked out. So
just
he
like
left.
That.
Just like that. And now I've been driving to L.A. for years, handing out coffee mugs, bobbleheads, shaking hands, buying suits, pretending I was in L.A. when I wasn't to meet people. "Oh, I just happened to be in. Let's have a meeting." And I drive my ass all the way there for a 10-minute meeting. You name it, every gimmick in the book to get jobs. I've done it all. And here we walk in, literally shake hands, talk for 30 minutes, and then he leaves. And literally after he left, I turned to Jamie and Joseph, who I know well, and I said,
What happened?
Did we just, and then Joseph and Jamie, it's funny because Harry and Joseph look at me and they go, "Welcome to the family. You got your show here." Then they stood up and then they shook my hand and walked away. And then me and Lefty were sat in the room and we're both looking at each other and goes, "Did we just get a show in Vegas? I'd like to get a confirmation on, do we have a show here? Is that really how it just happened?" And sure enough, that's exactly how it happened. We shook hands, and then literally like 3 months later, we opened, and we were there 2.5 years. And that's literally how it happened, that random. And that, you know, and it was a 2-page contract, and that was it.
That's what I was about to ask you. Did they hand you a contract or say, hey, we'll write it up and send you something later? Or?
Yeah, they said, we'll write it up, send it to you later. And 3 months later, they wrote me a contract on the terms. And it was a two-page contract, literally a mom-and-pop contract, you know, something I'd make with you if you were to come in and hang out with me and maybe do a corporate show with me. It'd be just, here's your fee, one day off. You got 30 days to, you know, if you want a day off, just let us know in a 14-day advance. You get this much pay, 6 month contract, and everything negotiable later, and that's it.
Well, that's so surprising, yeah, because I was about to say the same thing. You know, my contracts will be just a couple of pages. I mean, if I'm engaging someone for a trade show contract, I mean, it's a lot more lengthy than just 2 pages, and you're going to be having Las Vegas showroom of your own over there.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. So, but there was enough trust, and they knew you and everything, and so it was kind of a handshake as well as a hand signature. Right.
And also the last 6 months or the last 6 or 8 months, we didn't even have a contract, you know, because we had so many contracts. And after a while, you start proving yourself. And I think they realize, you know, my name's on everything, my marquee's on everything. And I'm, you know, if I say I'm going to do something, I do it. I've always been that way. And if I don't do it, either I really forgot or I missed an email or a note or didn't get a phone call and somebody assumed I was supposed to be there. But, you know, most of the time, 95, 98%, I'm on my game. Yeah. So, and also we have those past contracts. So if there's something to go awry, we always could go back in the last 2 years and go, well, hang on, why would it change now? But it was never an issue like that, you know. And all the debts were paid and all the costs were paid and all the income was paid back, and it was a really good relationship with us. You know, it was like any business relationship. You have your good days or bad days. You get an email going, oh my god, we got to do this now. And because don't forget, I was a third party. I was a headliner at Tropicana, but my path was me attached to the Laugh Factory, and then the Laugh Factory attached to the Tropicana. So I had no real contract with the Tropicana. Mm-hmm. They just gave me the blessing to be there. They didn't have to have me there, because, you know, every hotel has a brand and who they want to have there. But they gave the blessing, and that's about it. So the Laugh Factory is the one that I was, you know, in bed with, whereas Laugh Factory was in bed with the Tropicana. So that's kind of how that worked.
And with the Laugh Factory and your show that you had, like the early one, like at 7 o'clock, and then there was another comedian or someone that came on later, I think.
Yeah.
So they had other things happening in that venue.
Yeah. Originally my show was at 7 o'clock, then they had an 8:30 and a 10:30 show, with their standard comedy show, which is three comedians, which is this typical, you know, Laugh Factory show from Hollywood. And then Roseanne Barr wanted to come in, of course, so she took the 7 o'clock spot. I bumped to 4 o'clock, and then when I bumped to 4 o'clock, because they were producing my show, you know, it was like a two-wall deal, meaning they would help with cost and advertising. I would bring the talent, and then we'd split net profits at the end of it, whatever our percentages were. It wasn't, you know, in my sense where I was renting a room, which happens all over Vegas now.
And that's the four wall. I was going to ask you about the difference, to explain that to people, to understand about four wall versus two wall. Okay.
Yeah, four wall is basically kind of like, you know, what most people do in life, or a lot of people do when if they rent an apartment or rent a house. You know, you're paying rent to live in four walls, and whatever happens to those four walls is your responsibility. You know, you spill grape juice on the carpet, it's your responsibility to clean the carpet or get new carpets. You know, a hole happens in the wall, you fix that. If you lose money on the property or make money, it doesn't matter. You just got to pay your rent every month, and whatever you do within that property is your own world. Whereas a two-wall would be like a landlord helping you out. So maybe they would give you a house to live in. This is just for layman terms. Give you a house to live in for free if you took care of the yard work and painted the house and you took care of it. Almost like what people do in apartment complexes when they're managers. If you're a manager of an apartment complex, you'll probably get the place to live in for free, but you'll have the responsibility of managing the apartment. Maybe you get a small fee. And that's what a two-wall would be in the theater world. You know, you get given your show.
And
you
so
bring the talent, they bring the, you know, the venue.
If you're someone like Celine Dion, then that's a no wall, I guess. They just pay you X amount of dollars and you don't do anything.
Yes, or if you have enough buying power or you have enough ticket selling power, they'll go into business with you. So you'll bring your show in free. They'll pay all the costs of the orchestra, the fees, the union. And then what will happen is sometimes your fee, and everyone's different. I mean, I've heard Jimmy Buffett, when he comes in and plays, he gets 110% of the ticket sales. 110%.
Wow.
Yep, I didn't say it wrong. 110% the ticket. So if he goes into a 14,000 seat arena and he's selling out 14,000 seats, and they'll do an average on that, and then his paycheck will be 110% of that, and then the venue will get all the alcohol. because his type of shows, there's so many drinkers, so many partiers, so they make a fortune on alcohol, so he'll charge 110% of the ticket value. Or it'll go the other way around. He'll get, you know, vendorship of alcohol and vice versa, but a lot of artists have that buying power. Now, with Celine Dion, she's one of the number one selling artists in the world just because she covers every genre. You know, kids watch her on Disney and adults listen to her, and then she's got a couple of pop songs, and her show's great. So I don't know what her deal is, but, you know, that would be probably a similar deal as well, because say you got a flat fee of whatever it might be, but if you were to sell every house in that showroom or every seat, you'd probably make three times the amount. Mm-hmm. So when you have that power to sell that many tickets, you don't want to short sell yourself. So it's worth you taking a percentage of every seat being sold versus just a buyout guarantee, because you probably can make more money. So it's definitely a give and take depending on each artist.
So that's not called a no wall. What would that be called? I mean, there's two wall, four wall.
That could be a guarantee. A guarantee with a percentage, you know, a guarantee with a percentage.
Back end or something.
Yeah, a back end deal. Mm-hmm. But a layman's term would be a two wall, where you bring the talent, they do the ads, you do a deal split, you know.
Yeah.
And basically a two wall is almost like you're sharing the cost of a venue, meaning, you know, my talent is my cost, but it doesn't cost me anything because that's what I do. And then the venue, you know, if they own the venue, well, they can, you know, they can give that to you free as well because they're owners, you know, so it's a, you know.
And when you were two-walling at the Tropicana, and will be then shortly here at Planet Hollywood, are they responsible for the advertising, and then do you supplement that then as well, or you tell them kind of what you need, or they give you a budget and then you arrange for the advertising, or do you work with the ad agencies, or how does that work?
It's a balance, you know, depending what you want, whether you want billboards, you want magazine ads, you want flyers, you want coupons, you want rack cards up and down the I-15 or 95, which are the main freeways in and out of Las Vegas from Arizona and, Arizona, Utah, and California. And also property advertising. So it's a give and take, you know. A lot of times they'll give you the spots and then they'll charge you a flat rate for ads, and then that'll be paid out of the gross monies of the show, and then once the net profits in, you'll do a deal split with the venue, and then you don't pay rent for the theater, you don't pay a lot of certain things like that, or the rent will be percentage based. So if you have one ticket sale, well, maybe your rent's 8% or 10% of the ticket sale, so that's your rent. So therefore there's no upfront cost out of pocket where, and the beautiful thing with the two wall is when you make money, everyone makes money. With a four wall, it's one sided in the sense of if you don't have ticket selling power, it could cost you a lot of money, and then all of a sudden the venue makes a lot of money and you make none. Or what happens is you make none, you have a 6-month contract, and 2 months in you realize I'm out of money, I gotta leave. Mm-hmm. So then you pull the plug, you leave. Now the venue loses the show, so now they don't know who they're gonna put in next, and then you're out of money, so both places lose. I mean, there was a show in Vegas recently called George on My Mind, which is a Ray Charles tribute, and it ran for 6 weeks. I went to the opening. I mean, it was a great, great opening. Lots of people there. 6 weeks. They only had 6 weeks at the Venetian in the Phantom of the Opera room. Beautiful room here. Tim and Faith Hill were, Tim McGraw and Faith Hill were in the room for like a year residency or 2 years. Beautiful room. Big room though. I mean, the room I think holds over 1,800, give or take a bit. And they had a 6-week run. That was it. And literally 3.5 weeks in, they pulled the plug. And it frustrates me because when producers come in and you say you only have a 6-week run, even for vanity, the investor or the producer should go, look, if we didn't sell a ticket for 6 weeks, no matter what, we're going the 6 weeks. 6 weeks is a very short run. Mm-hmm. And to pull a plug on 3.5 weeks in, it just makes the producers not look strong, makes the Venetian not look that strong, and also the artists on stage. So it's just a no-win for nobody. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, and to pull a plug, I can see somebody pulling a plug with a year contract or 6 months or 2 years. But when you say we're only here for 6 weeks, it's a limited run, and then 3.5 weeks in you pull a plug, it's really, shows a lot how not strong the show is, or how it's not selling tickets, you know. And nobody knows. If you can fake it for 6 weeks, fake it, you know, can leave, and maybe ticket numbers were low, but at least you had a 6-week run, which isn't that long at all. You
know? Well, was it just that they weren't selling tickets? Because if they weren't, I would think they would try to tweak it a little bit, and they say, okay, well, this isn't working, we need to do something, whether it's in our advertising strategy, some sort of marketing that needs to be changed, perhaps the actors, the script, something, you know, perhaps needs to be tweaked. But they didn't do that. They just said, hey, we don't have tickets, we're out. Wow.
I know, and the problem is, I think sometimes people overspend so high, you know, I mean, when you have a cast of between 25 and 35 people, the overhead's astronomical. You know what I mean? I don't know whether on percentage or guarantees. My assumption would be guarantees. And when you have that kind of money you're spending, that's a lot of money, mm-hmm. To be going out the window. But people who come from the East Coast or LA or New York or Chicago, it doesn't matter where you come from, you really think you have this original brand. We're in Vegas. There's tons of people. Of course they're going to come. Yeah, but everyone's vying for the same ticket. You know what I mean? When people come here, sure, like, and I've always told people this, my show isn't a destination show. Cirque du Soleil is a destination show. Rod Stewart's a destination show. Celine Dion's a destination show. Blue Man Group's a destination show. That's the type of people who are in Texas or are in LA, and they go, we're going to Vegas for 4 days. We're definitely going to see Cirque du Soleil's Michael MJ1. We're mm-hmm. going to see Blue Man. So you booked your tickets going, I'm going to take my wife or my husband or my kids to see this show. We booked a trip, we booked a hotel, and we're seeing this show. That's why we're going, because we've always wanted to see this show. Then you have 3 extra days here, and then I'm the show that people go to see going, hey, we got a Sunday, nothing to do. Let's go check out Murray for under 100, you know, $120 right. or whatever. We can go see Murray, seeing the guy in Pawn Stars. That'll be fun. So I'm a show after you get here as an afterthought, and I'm okay with that. You know, but a lot of people don't understand where they fit in. They feel like, oh, I'm going to compete with Copperfield. Well, I'm not competing with Copperfield. He's a legend. He's been around for over 40 years.
Right.
And he's a destination show. You know, people come here and go, Copperfield's in town. We got to go see him. And so, you know, you got to know where you're at.
Well, you remind me then of not only accepting where you are in the total pyramid of things, I guess, but also sure. like Avis, you know, they used to advertise saying, we're number two. Well, it's better than being number three. I remember also like USA Today as well. You know, they said, we want to be your second newspaper, you know. So, and by being the second newspaper, they ended up being the number one newspaper because, in other words, we want you to read your local newspaper and be familiar with what's happening there. But also on the national scale, you need to read USA Today to find out what's happening in the USA Today. Yes. And as a result, you know, let's say that the Houston Chronicle, I would subscribe to that, read that, and then supplement that with USA Today. You know, people in Dallas are reading, you know, their morning newspaper or Atlanta, whatever, and then having USA Today as their second newspaper. As a result, circulation-wise, they were able to get more. But same thing, like I said, with Avis, you know, being number two. And so I think
that's funny. I didn't know that. That's great, though.
Yeah.
We will return to my chat with Murray in a moment, but first I want to tell you about something exciting that's coming up in 2015. Have you ever wanted to attend Hogwarts, where you can learn the real secrets behind being a successful magician? There is so much more to the magic business than just the magic. We know enough tricks and have our own polished routines and acts, but how many of us just don't know how to market ourselves? How much are we worth in our marketplace? Perhaps you are underpricing yourself. Don't you think it'd be helpful to know how to be as polished on the business side of your art as you are with your magic? At Magic Business University, or MBU, you can learn a lot about how to prepare a contract, dealing with your customer, whether it's the parent of a birthday child or a CEO of a major corporation, how to manage your finances, building and generating business from your website, building a brand and using social media to increase your brand, promoting yourself and getting on television, plus broader applications of these fundamentals as they apply to kids' shows, restaurants, street magic, trade shows, and corporate mentalism. There will also be some specific topics like the $1,000 a day show plan, fundraising shows, campground shows, and more. All of these will be taught by people who are recognized as some of the top professionals in their respective fields. The faculty includes Jim Sisti, David Thiel, Dennis Alm, Mark Salem, Devin Knight, Tom Crowell, Joseph Cursillo, Cosmo, Joe Atmore, Eric Henning, and myself, Scott Wells, with more to be added soon. And that's not all. Each registrant will receive a certificate of completion or a diploma, a free t-shirt, a workbook, and a free promo headshot taken by professional photographer Michael Messing. All this will take place in Clinton, New Jersey on April 17th through Sunday the 19th, 2015. You can save $100 off the full registration price if you register before January the 15th, 2015. We recognize that during this holiday season and the end of the fiscal year that some of you might be a little stretched and tight on funds. So, for only a $50 deposit, you can hold your spot for MBU through February the 15th, 2015. when the balance will be due without incurring the increase on January the 15th. What a perfect way to start the new year by investing in you. With the increased revenue you will earn by employing the strategies you will learn at MBU, you can afford to attend other conventions next year and buy more magic for your act. Save yourself some money by registering today at magicbusinessuniversity.com and turn your passion into profits. And now, back to our conversation with Murray.
Knowing where you are in the scheme of things and not having, you know, I was going to say too high of a value. I mean, certainly that you do have high value, but in recognition and comparison with some of the others and with reality. I think sometimes magicians just don't have a reality check. They think, okay, well, I'm number one. You know, why shouldn't you? We all have big egos. You know, certainly I think you have to whenever that, you know, a customer or a potential client calls you and that you're going to say, well, you shouldn't go anyplace else. You should stick with me. Or, you know, you're walking up to someone in a strolling situation that you know, whatever that you have to show them is more important than whatever conversation that they're having then, right then. At that time, they could be talking about a dying relative, but hey, I want to show you a card trick, you know. So you have to have an ego that sure. would be larger than large enough to want to have them to watch you.
Of course.
Yeah.
And you know, also I was taught years ago, and this is true, and it's funny, people don't realize that, but, you know, my main mentor was Marvin Roy, Mr. Electric,
right.
You know, and Carol, so most people know that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd always sit around and talk with them because they were back in the day, they were following the Channing Pollocks, the Norm Nielsens, and them, you know, and a lot of other variety act, like the Glovers used to do a hand balancing act on the Ed Sullivan Show. A lot of people don't know that, like an acro type act, a very famous act back in the day. And a lot of really famous vaudeville type performers. And like Marv said, you know, when we created the act wasn't created to be the headliner or to be the star. We created the act to be an opening act for the stars. That's what our role was. Our role as magicians, creating a 4 or a 10 or a 12 or 15 minute act, was a vignette to open for a bigger act, you know, mm-hmm. like a Carol Channing or a Nat King Cole or whoever else was out there in those days.
Right.
It was never to be a headliner like Siegfried and Roy. They were an act at the Tropicana in the fall.
Yeah, they opened up for Liberace.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that was never our goal. It just happened to fall into that place as times changed and they became in the forefront and a headlining type act and a feature because of how great they were and who they were. So, and anytime, he's always taught me when I did my CD act years ago and anytime, so whenever you do a variety show, Murray, open, always open. I don't care how big you are, always open. The beautiful thing with that is you never follow anybody that could be better than you. So you're always the best. Even if you're the worst, you're the best because you're the only act opening. Mm. And then by the time the show done, as he says, usually you get paid the same. And then by the time the show's done, you're packed up, you're at the bar having a martini or a glass of wine, you can meet and greet people and have a great time. Whereas if you're doing these shows and you're the closing act, well, you're spent backstage packing up while everyone else is having a nice time shaking hands. And he says, the reason you want to be outside shaking hands again, because that's your next gig. You're shaking hands with producers. You're meeting people. That gets to the next gig, and you want to be always available for that. So I learned a lot from him, and he always said that, you know your position. So I've always learned that, you know, and I've always told people I'm 90%, you know, marketing and 10% talent, you know. And he says, know where you're at. And I've always been a big believer of that. And it's kind of done me well, you know, because a lot of people think I'm bigger than I really am. And I'm just a guy doing tricks, you know.
Well, that's good advice also. I just was thinking about that. Whenever that I'm finished with a show, oftentimes, of course, I'm doing a banquet or something for a company. And then I have my own curtain that's on the stage. And so I'll stand behind the curtain putting things away. And perhaps I should be out front shaking hands and, you know, if someone wants to take a picture or whatever. And, you know, because a lot of times people will come back behind the curtain and say, hey, I want to thank you. Great show, whatever. I should be out there, kind of, sure. I guess.
Why not? It's only 10 minutes of your time or 15.
I never thought
and
about that.
You're shaking
that
hands, handing out business cards, and people do want a picture with you because you've done something really cool. You've brought somebody up on stage that they didn't expect would ever get up on stage, an executive or a vice president or CEO or the secretary. And, you know, you're part of their life now, whether you like it or not. And some people put that picture on their mantelpiece, on their office desk, or just in their computer somewhere, or on Facebook now, or the internet. And, you know, I always tell people, the worst thing I think people can do is when they walk out on stage, go, no flash photography, no video, no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in this day and age. Back in the day, it was different because we didn't have the capacity to sell ourselves like we do now on the internet for free. Right. We had to hire publicists and get newspapers. And it's a beautiful thing now, where now I tell people to take all the pictures they want. So when they leave my show, I got 40 to 100 people to maybe 200 people that are actually Instagramming and Twittering and Facebooking my photos with theirs. And that's unsolicited, unpaid advertising. It's just happening because they want to brag they were in Vegas or they were, you know, we saw this show, we were this person, whether they know me or not. And I tell people of all sorts, I say, tell them to do that because that's going to advertise you. Don't worry about somebody stealing your bit. Now on the internet, if they're going to steal your bit, they're going to steal your bit. It's all over the place. It's pretty hard to, those days are done. You can, a lot of people go, well, I'm not going to do that because I don't want people stealing my bit. I'm like, let's be honest. If Elton John or those guys allow photos in their show, let's go. You know, you're not Elton John, so let's put things in perspective.
Well said.
You know, and so if somebody's stealing a little rope bit or the way you link a Chinese linking ring is not going to change. You know, people get hung up on this stuff, and I'm like, okay, let's go. So you know, Barbara Streisand. So that's the way I've always learned. I learned it from Terry Fader. You know, Terry Fader did that in town, mm-hmm. and you know, he sells very well. The ventriloquist here, and he said, guys, look. I know you guys got your cameras. You're hiding them. I see them. Look, if you want to take pictures, take all the pictures you want. If you want to take video, go for it. If you take video, just do it for a minute or two. Don't videotape the whole damn show. It's because you're here to see me live. See me live. If you want to buy a video, it's $20 in the lobby. You know, you can go on YouTube. You can find all my stuff. It's just so, and it's funny. Boom, that first 10 minutes flashes. Everybody gets out of their system.
Yeah.
After 15 minutes, guess what? They're like, oh, okay, it's not a big deal anymore. It's not sneaky. And they enjoy the show.
So. That's a good point. Well, you know, you really are aggressive as far as your marketing goes. I mean, I've got like 5,000 friends on my Facebook page, and so it's like a ticker tape, you know, kind of going through, you know, whenever. I'm not able to see everybody. However, I catch you more often. You and Steve Chesaday are the two guys, seems like, that post a lot. And so I'm able to see those posts coming through. If people post, you know, once a week or once a day or just, you know, every once in a while, irregularly, you know, you might miss those opportunities. But it seems like you are always on there. Plus, I'm assuming, as you say, using Instagram and Twitter and everything else. So any advice?
Yeah. Well, I use that stuff, and I always tell people with Facebook and that. I mean, they're sure that my mom has Facebook, and she has 26 friends, and they really are her friends, and that's all she uses it for. You know, she's not, you know, she's very private, so she should be. And my parents, you know, my mom and dad.
Yep. Same with Kathy, my wife. You know, she's got like 12 people and family. That's it. I don't want
anyone. Exactly. Yeah. And then it's fun because you can upload things. You can maybe be a bit more emotional on Facebook. And I see this happen a lot. I think it's a big mistake, especially for professionals, because I see a lot of professionals using it as an emotional counseling device where they'll be peed off about a driving incident or a relationship issue or a job issue, and they'll use it. And I've seen acts right on there going, well, I guess so-and-so didn't want me. Just got fired today from so-and-so. They can go stick it up their so-and-so. And, and I'm thinking, well, now that's no good because, okay, you're upset about the company, and you're obviously writing that hoping they're going to see it or someone's going to see it from that world. But what you've just done is told another world that might have hired you how ridiculous you are, and that if they hire you or something goes wrong, you're probably going to blast all over the internet about that company. Yeah, so therefore, now you're a risk. So now, okay, you're getting off your system. You think you're, or even if it's a girlfriend or a boyfriend you're breaking up from, or whatever it is, people write this emotional stuff, and it just makes you look a little crazy. And people, and sure, we all have those moments. We all call our friend going, holy Christ, you're not going to believe this. But leave that for that. And my advice is use Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, all this, for if you're in my world, you know, professional and like your world, and you have that many friends. I mean, yeah, I have 5,000 friends on Facebook. I know two people on there. Let's be honest. My wife and and you.
And me.
I mean, as you know, and that's a little less. But realistically, I probably know about 12% of those people on there. And the rest are people I just clicked on and I accepted them.
Sure.
And so me writing how I feel or upset, it doesn't do me any good. And there's no need for that. But people do that continuously, and I don't think it's a wise decision, especially
posting religious and political comments as well.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
again,
tough.
That they have be very passionate about something. That's well and good, but don't post it because that lives out there forever.
Sure, it does. Unless you have a blog and you are that, you're a Bill Maher or something who wants to get out there and share their thought, or a Rush Limbaugh or whatever.
Right.
That's your game. That's your gimmick, and that's your thing. But when it's a person like that and you're trying to get gigs from various areas, people read these. I mean, it's amazing how many people are bookers at casinos or Indian casinos or talent agents to see that stuff. And that's why I do it. And the beautiful thing about Facebook is when I meet somebody, whether it be a casting director or a producer, I always Facebook them. And I love to see where they're at. Oh, they got two kids. Oh, they live over here. Oh, they smoke cigars. I love that stuff. So when I go meet them or speak with them, there's a bit of, I go, oh, hang on, you guys like smoking cigars, or you like golfing, or you like fishing or whatever. And it's kind of a neat way to see behind the scenes of a Wikipedia or a website that we only put serious stuff that we want to share with people on there.
You know, I've heard also an idea for mentalists to use. So that way, if you're going to be going and doing something for someone at a particular show and you say, well, who's going to be there? Who's the CEO? Or, you know, can you tell me some of the vice presidents or some of the other people? A lot of these guys will have Facebook accounts, and you can go in and find out something like the name of their dog or something. And, you know, that pre-show information is awful valuable, you know, for performing in your show.
I never thought of that. I mean, in that sense, because I'm not a mentalist, but that's, of course you'd use that. Why not? It's very wise.
And so I do want to go and talk then about the new show that's going to be coming up then right now. December the 10th, you'll be opening then at Planet Hollywood. Tell me a little bit. So was this something, by the way, then, Murray, that you had planned and you knew it was going to transition? And, I mean, you knew there was an ending for Tropicana, or did you end that because you knew this was coming up, or how did that kind of evolve?
No, the way all that happened, and we're actually opening December 20th now. Now, the news release originally went out December 10th, but it's actually December 20th. That's my own fault because we actually made a typo. It's actually December 20th. But I know on the press release it said December 10th, and a couple of people picked that up. We had to get it changed, but it's December 20th. December 10th, me and Chloe, my wife, are finally having our honeymoon. We're going to Tahiti for a week, so we're not going to be anywhere in the States for that time. But December 20th, we're back open, and I had no inkling necessarily going to Planet Hollywood this soon or at this time. We've always talked to Caesars Entertainment. Caesars Entertainment owns like 7 hotels in Vegas. You know, they own Caesars Hotel, obviously, and Harris, along with the Flamingo, Planet Hollywood, Bally's, and the Rio, and a few others. And they're a viable source, and it's a big corporation, you know, like MGM Grand Mirage. They own the Mirage. They own MGM Grand Mandalay Bay, Luxor, the list goes on. Wow. So those are two massive corporations in Vegas, along with independently owned hotels like the Venetian with Sheldon Adelson. The other one is Phil Ruffin with Treasure Island. Donald Trump bought the Frontier property, which is not there anymore. It's just a parking lot now. But or Tropicana, which is owned by Alex, who's an independent owner, used to be the vice president of MGM. So there's these islands of hotels, and then there's the corporations. And I've always talked to Caesars. I've always liked them. I've always known they back their entertainers. They always have great entertainment from massive stars like the Rod Stewart, Celine Dion's, but they also got other great shows on their properties, and they love entertainment. So I've always been looking at them, and I've always had good relationships with them, along with a lot of other entertainment directors in town. And you always meet, and you shake hands, and you keep business cards, because you never know. And then literally, I was talking on the phone like this to you, to my producer. He calls me, and at 10 in the morning, this is like a month and a half ago, 6 weeks ago, I guess, and Harry, and he calls, hey, Mer, and see the phone, 10 in the morning. I'm like, 10 in the morning, it's kind of early. Usually I'm not up, you know, and running at that time. And so I'm reading my paper on the patio with my coffee. I said, hey, Harry, what's up? He says, hey, I just got a call from the vice president of Tropicana. Now, just as a word of advice, and I'm sure you know this, Scott, but when you get a call at 10 in the morning, and then it follows up with, I got a call from the vice president of the hotel about an hour ago, usually it's never going to go.
It's not good. Yeah, right.
They're not calling for a promotion. That it's not that urgent.
Your it's kind of like, have you got a minute to come in and visit with us?
Yes, it's never good. So that's always, you know, usually at the end of the day it's a good thing, but if it's at 9 in the morning and they have, can we have a meeting, it's usually a problem. So I thought, now I've always been waiting for this day. I think in business you always wait for that day. It's always happened. Doesn't matter where you work. Exactly. You get the call going, hey, they're not booking this anymore. They're not doing it. You know, kind of like when we all played in Texas, where you're from, you know, Houston at the Magic Club there. Yeah, Magic Island. We always did that. We always had a couple of weeks a year. You probably had a lot more than I did, but, you know, I'd have a couple of weeks a year. And it's always that 2 weeks a year you put in your calendar, some fun money, get to see some friends, and then all of a sudden that's the end of it. It happens. Like Wizards in California, and the list goes on. So I get the call and say, hey, there's another magician coming in to the big showroom, and it's Jan Rovin, and he's opening November the 28th. So your contract that goes to October 30th, we're going to have to, you know, end it. Because I would always get 6 months, extensions, you know. Right. And so the 6 months ended October 30th, and then we'd always extend another 6 months. There was never an issue. Mm-hmm. And he wants to play the big room. Well, the big room holds 1,100 seats downstairs. And my room that I'm in is a comedy club upstairs. Second level holds 300. And with him coming in, he has so many big props in that. And, of course, he's tied in with the casino. Like, when he goes into Four Wall, his deal is directly with the casino. Mine is with Laugh Factory, then Laugh Factory is with the casino.
Okay.
So I'm a byproduct. So he has a no-compete agreement of Magic. So basically he wins because, you know, the union cost in that room is between $24,000 and $38,000 a week. That's the union cost.
But he's not doing Magic.
Yes, Jan Rovin's a magician.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He's had a show at the Riviera for 2.5-3 years now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, he's
German. Okay, I know who you're talking about then. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. He's been on a couple of TV shows and Master of Illusion. Nice guy, you know.
He does big illusions, right?
That's right. And very good. Speaks great English, speaks great German, of course, and a bunch of other languages. And he's actually a dear friend of mine. You know, we just finished shooting Extreme Escapes. It's coming up on Reels channel for 26 episodes starting November 29th. So we're friends. But, you know, in business, business is business, you know, and I've always been a firm believer, you know, friends are friends and business is business. And so all of a sudden I get this phone call. I thought, oh, Jesus. I said, so that's the end of that situation. And literally I said, all right, so we're ending October 30th. And literally I got the call, I guess, at the end of September. So I had literally 4.5 weeks to figure out what's going on. And I totally understood it. You know, he's going in the big room. Mm-hmm. I've been there for 2.5 years. If I wanted to go in the big room, I could have pitched it and moved in there. But it's not in my makeup. It's you know, it's 1,100 seats. And I don't know how you sell 1,100 seats a day, 6 days a week, when you're not Celine Dion. You know what I mean? Like,
or
I just
David
don't know how you do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, Copperfield's across the street at the MGM Grand is a 780-seat theater.
Yeah, literally across the street.
Yeah, and he sells out most of the time. He does pretty well, you know, but even there stays a few seats that are empty. That's 780. He's Copperfield. So, I don't know. I don't have the confidence. You know, like, hey, we all got to have confidence. But I don't know how you get that to sell 1,100 or mentally think you can sell 1,100 seats. So, but power to them. And so they came in. So I said, great. And I immediately, of course, went to the press and said, congratulations to Jan Rovin. Because it is, you know, he's doing it as a career move. He moved from the Riviera to the Trop. And it's definitely an upgrade for him. You know, it's a similar brand of hotel, that era.
Yeah.
But the Trop's been renovated. It's a beautiful hotel now. And it's iconic. And it's a bigger theater where he can do, you know, he bought Melinda's Drill Trick, where Melinda got, you know, got a drill through her years ago, and so he bought that and a bunch of massive tricks, and he wants to do these, you know. So that's what happened. I got the news, and of course, the next, literally by, I'd say 11:30 that morning, I hung the phone after I talked to my producer. Literally, I have text messages from all the writers in town, John Katz, Norm Clark, Mike Weatherford, all asking my opinion on Jan Rovin coming to the Tropicana. I'm like, how does this happen all in an hour on the phone this morning? I was not seeing
this.
Well, I guess when the Trop called Harry saying, hey, Harry, just so you know, in an hour we're releasing that Jan Rovin's coming to the hotel. Just want to let you know Murray has to leave by October 30th in a month. And the news release is coming out today. Well, I didn't realize it was coming out today, meaning within like 45 minutes of me hanging up the phone. So
they'd made all the decisions, obviously, about you behind your back. And they were just letting you know, hey, thanks a lot. See ya.
Exactly. Because it's business, and that's the way things go in this town. And they wanted to surprise people in that. Jan Rovin and Frank, his producer, felt bad about it because it is business and we are friends. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's business. I get that. So, literally that whole day I was on the phone emailing people going, hey, you want to have a meeting? You want to have a meeting? Hey, let's have coffee. And these are all entertainment directors, people that own theaters. So I thought, here we go. And if you know anything about me, I'm an extremely aggressive business person. I don't waste time. And I'm the guy on the phone. I have a manager. I have publicists and I have agents. But I, unfortunately, I love those people and they're great for me. But you know, I'm really in the forefront. I really am aggressive. And then once it happens, then I pass it on to my managers because I love the business and I know it pretty well, you know. So away we went and we started having meetings for 3 weeks and I met 4 to 5 serious hotels in town. And then as a joke, I was filming a show in front of the Silverton Hotel called Battle of the Strand. It's a hair show. And I was doing a magic trick on their finale episode. And the set was literally in the parking lot of the Silverton Hotel.
Now, where's the Silverton? I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, the Silverton is basically, I'd say, a half a mile off the strip on the I-15 coming into Vegas.
Oh, okay.
So it's more of a locals casino or one that, you know, they have a Bass Pro Shop there. So it's people who are truckers or, you know, guys with RVs that want to pull in, stay a couple nights. You can get a room for $30 a night. They're a real nice hotel. But we were right below the sign And I just announced, well, everyone knew that Jan Robin's coming in, I'm leaving, everyone called me, and I had to give the press an answer, so I did. And I called Jan, so I made a press release saying, congratulating Jan Robin. I called Jan, I said, congratulations, man, this is great for you. He said, oh my God, Murray, I said, I'm so glad you're talking to me still. I thought this is going to be another war with a magician. I said, no, I'm not like that. If you know me, I'm not like that. You know, you didn't do it vindictively, you're making a career decision.
Sure.
I mean, it's life. So I got a picture outside the Silverton. And I took other pictures that day of me on set. So for most people who do look at my Facebook or anything social media, they'd go, oh, he's just shooting there. But I didn't realize that because the news came out a few days before that. And then me with a picture in front of the Silverton, mm-hmm. It caught on going, oh, my God, you're moving to the Silverton. I thought, oh, this is really funny that people think – now, people outside of Vegas say, oh, a new hotel. I don't know what it is. People who are in Vegas going, holy Christ, you're going to the Silverton. What are you doing? And because it's really not a venue for shows. I mean, they have shows there, but it's not. So I realized that's interesting. So literally for the next 3 weeks, every hotel I took pictures in front of, from the Days Inn to Motel 6 to the Venetian.
I saw some of those, yeah.
Yeah. So it became a funny thing, which people were like, oh, my God, you're so genius at marketing. And it had nothing to do with genius. I was just messing around, trying to have some fun. And it became
Is it going to be here? Is it going to be here?
Yeah. So I did that. I met with a bunch of people. And there was, out of those 30, there was 5 real hotels that I was really talking with, sitting down in board meetings with press kits and, you know, sharing my worth. And then John Payden, who's the owner of Sin City Comedy, which is a 300-seat theater in Planet Hollywood Hotel. And they have 3 venues at Planet Hollywood. They have the massive theater that holds 8,000 people, which Britney Spears is in, and J-Lo is going to come in. Then they have an 1,800-seat theater with Jeff Dunham's going to come in there, and that's where the Jacksons were in Meatloaf. And then they have a smaller venue, which is a 300-seat room.
There was one also in there where Steve Weirich used to be years ago, too, isn't it?
Yeah, see, that's the misconception. That's not Planet Hollywood.
It's
that's
not.
A mall.
Oh.
It's called Miracle Mile Mall.
Okay.
And basically, it has nothing to do with Planet Hollywood except that the mortar and cement is stuck to it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it, they had a legal problem a few years ago because everyone would say, hey, we're Planet Hollywood. Well, realistically, no, you're in a mall beside Planet Hollywood. It's kind of like I'm playing the Taj Mahal. Well, no, I'm in a tent beside the Taj Mahal, but I'm close. So indirectly, and I'm, you know, no disrespect to anybody there, but realistically, no, they have nothing to do with Caesars Entertainment. They have nothing to do with Planet Hollywood. But it's, if you read it, they're at American Mile Mall beside Planet Hollywood. But they have it all in there, and they can use it as long as they put that. So,
okay. So go ahead, then, with the story.
Yeah. So anyways, I had met with John Payden, who's a comedian, and, you know, he's been in town for 20 years. And he's really one of us. He's like Harry Basil, who's my producer at the Laugh Factory. He's been a comedian for 30 years. He gets the business. He knows how to – he understands a mom-and-pop grassroots entertainer like myself, which isn't Celine Dion or Rod Stewart that has producers and publicists and all this stuff that really drive their ticket sales. And so we met, went back and forth with them and a couple other hotels, and then we, you know, struck up a deal and said, let's do this. Let's make it happen. Because the beautiful thing about my show being the Tropicana is I had a 2.5-year run. You know, in a hotel that have only had headliners last 4 to 6 months there. I mean, literally, me and Mike Weatherford had a laugh. The writer in town said, Murray, do you realize you're the longest headliner at the Tropicana since the Follies Bergère left? And now a lot of people go, wait a minute, wasn't Rick Thomas there for 5 years? Yes, he was, but he was there with the Follies. He was there with all those people. But since Follies left, Rick went with them as well because they were doing, you know, share splitting the room and all that.
Right.
He did his own thing. He went to Stardust and then he went to Orleans Hotel and then he went touring. But since they left, there was Gladys Knight, there was Wayne Noon, Recycled Percussion, Dancing with Stars. Mamma Mia lasted 12 weeks there, you know. So literally I've been there 2.5 years and it's true. And I just, I'm saying it more as a joke, not an ego thing. I think it's funny. Little old me in a closet upstairs on the second level, doing some tricks.
Maybe they didn't know about you and forgot about you. That's why.
Honest to God, I wouldn't be surprised, God. So literally that's kind of, you know, flying under the radar. And the key is in Vegas is make sure your overhead is less than, you know, less than what you're bringing in, and you'll make money, you know. With these shows, they have so much overhead, you can't keep it rolling, you know. So that's the key. So literally, I'm taking my show, which is turnkey, and I'm going into a similar size theater and everything. It's actually a proper stage now, with good lighting, which is going to make everything look a little better. But, you know, it's not like it's a big jump. It's not like I'm moving to the Coliseum and I got to manage a train or produce a Ferrari, you know.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about, adding some illusions, because as I understand it, the little blurb that I had read not only talked about your new show starting, but also the extension, I think, for another 4 years on Matt King's show, who has been the longest running day show, I guess, in Las Vegas, even longer than Siegfried and Roy, you know, for like 15 years. And so they said that Caesars usually doesn't pit competing acts, that is, you know, comedy magicians on the same time slot, afternoons, against each other. So I understand you're going to be differentiating yourself a little bit, perhaps, by doing some illusions in addition to comedy, or what?
Yeah, I'll be doing illusions with comedy as well, and I'll also be tying in a lot more of my reality-based shows. You know, right now I got three.
Now, what does that mean, tying that in?
Well, you know, people see me on Pawn Stars, you know, and they see me talking about Houdini and the handcuffs and the straitjackets and that, and they all know me from the show, but I really don't bring that up during my show. I don't share any insight of education on that, and I think a lot of people, when you meet Rick Harrison, who runs the pawn shop, you want to hear him tell a story about an item that came into the store, because you're a
fan. Right.
You know, you want to hear about when I was on Wizard Wars, what was it like creating magic within an hour or two to compete on the Sci-Fi Channel Wizard Wars, or any of these shows, and people want to have a little piece of that to go home with going, this is pretty cool, we got to meet him, he shared something of his time on set that we all as a family in the middle of Iowa or in the middle of Arkansas saw him on. It's kind of cool to have that little insight that a lot of people don't, so I want to tie that in a little more to the show and share that. And you know, Matt King, I'm a huge fan of. I love Matt King. I'm a fan as well as a colleague in the business with him. And I don't look at it as competing. I mean, it's kind of looking like Caulfield is competing. I don't think I'm competing with Mac. He's been here for so long. He's got his fan base. He's got his support from the casino. And here's what's interesting. Because Caesars Entertainment owns like 7 hotels, and MGM Grand Mirage own like 6 or 7 or 8 hotels, they're looked at as one unit. But realistically, you know, I'm at Planet Hollywood, you know, and then down the row from Planet Hollywood, we got the Paris Hotel, you know, and then you got, you know, Bally's, and then you have, you know, a small casino called the Cromwell now, which used to be Buffalo Bills, or not Buffalo Bills, Bills Casino Gambling Hall. Then you have the Flamingo, and then you have Harris. So I'm almost 7 casinos away from Matt King. So competition-wise, when you look at casinos, if these casinos were owned individually, like Treasure Island, like Tropicana, like the Venetian, there'd be no competing. It would be just a different show. But Penn and Teller are at the Rio, and Matt King's at Harris, and they're both really strong magic shows. Yes, one's in the evening, and one's in the afternoon.
And both owned by Caesars Enterprises.
Exactly. So we can play that compete game as well. And I know Mike Weatherford wrote that, which, you know, we all like causing drama and news because people like to read stuff. I don't look at it as competing because, you know, I know Mac does his 1 and 3. I'm doing a 2 and 4. But, you know, my base comes from TV. You know, America's Got Talent, Pawn Stars, Sci-Fi, Wizard Wars. And now, you know, currently I'm on Master of Illusion on CW, which is coming back in January, for the month of January. I'm on Reels Channel, which is the Extreme Escapes, and I'm also on Pawn Stars. So I'm on 3 series right now. Whereas Mac does do TV, but he's much more grassroots. He's got a huge following with family bases in Vegas, with charity, with book clubs, with all that stuff. So I've never looked at it as competing, and I've always been a huge fan of Mac. So, so I've never really looked at that. Plus, we're so many hotels away. It's, you know, yeah, okay. We do similar things. We're comedian magicians in an afternoon spot, granted. But there's also other afternoon shows here that, you know, we're all competing for the same, you know, customer at that time. So.
And how long is this contract? It's going to be for 2 years?
It's a year contract.
A 1 year
It'll
contract.
Be a year contract. Starts at December 20th. It'll go for a year. You know, and all these contracts are negotiable, you know.
Sure.
And they always have out clauses and in clauses and all that stuff. But you know, for me, because I did a 2.5 year run at Tropicana, a year contract's very easy because, you know, when you come into Vegas, it really is a mentality. You know, when I first came to Vegas and did my show at the Frontier in 2002, and I believe you were there and you probably saw that show, I think.
I did.
I think you did come to town because we were doing, oh, I just came off the TOM conventions and doing all that circuit stuff. I thought, here, I won 24 awards. I'm a world champion magician. I got the CD Act. I'm original.
Right.
And then I come to Vegas and no one's original in Vegas. You know, it doesn't matter how great you are. And you realize it has nothing to do with how necessarily talented you are. It's how good you are getting people in your show, advertising, marketing, and how you pull people into your venue. And I didn't understand that, you know. And now, after being here 12 years, it's a whole different game. You know what I mean?
And I'm assuming that your contract this time is more than 2 pages long?
Yes, his contract's a little bit longer than 2 pages, but yeah. It's not much more. Honestly, it's not much more than that, because it really is a handshake. You know, because look, at the end of the day, if they screw me or I screw them, the contract's done. You know what right. I mean? That's really the way it is. They can pull out when they want. I can pull out when they want. It's, you know, it's when you do a two-wall or a partnership deal, it's talent versus ownership. And without either, you have nothing. Mm-hmm. So it really is a balance. And everyone's got to be making money. And I was taught this years ago by a good producer friend of mine in town. And they go, Murray, the key to being successful is when you go for a job and when you want longevity, whether you invest in a strip mall, you invest in mutual funds, you invest in your own show, and you have people in, the key is that everybody gets a slice of the pie. If somebody's getting, you know, 80% of that pie, and then another person's only getting, you know, 20%, somebody's making a lot more money than another person, and it's not always going to work. But if everyone's getting a good share of the pie, everyone's mm-hmm. getting fed, everyone's not going hungry,
and they're happy.
Yeah. And that's the way you move forward, become successful. Everyone's, you can all sit around, have a beer, and really share in that success. If somebody's taking a, you know, a crap load of money, and someone's not getting it, that's going to run short, because somebody else will come in and offer a better deal.
That's some good advice. Well, listen, I appreciate your time over here. I know that you got a lot of things that you're still working on here today. This is going to be a busy day. What would be today being a typical day in Murray's life? How does a typical day go with you?
Well, typical day would I'd wake up at this time, of course, in Las Vegas, which I woke up at 7 o'clock, put on a coffee, you know, a big pot of coffee and have a chat with you, do an interview like this. And I do an interview once every 2 or 3 days like this, you know. This is the earliest interview I've done in a long time. And I think the last time I did an interview like this was went to China or Australia or something like that. I had to get up this early. And then after this, I'm going to get changed, have a shower, and I'm going down to Opportunity Village, which is a place where they have people who have handicaps from – they have level 1 to 10 handicaps, so people that are very functioning, people that aren't as functioning, have any age, and basically it gives people an opportunity. That's why they call it Opportunity Village, to do anything, whether they could even help clean the area or make crafts or help with the building, but it's a great fundraising opportunity. Penn put this on the map, actually, when he did Celebrity Apprentice, and one of his things when he won, I think it was an ice cream thing where all the money went to Opportunity Village, Las Vegas, and put them on the map a lot. And basically, they have a thing at Christmas called the Magical Forest, and it's a forest where they probably have 180 trees. Some are real, like big pine trees, and some are imitation trees, all in this forest. And it's a winding path you walk that takes maybe 10, 15 minutes to go through, and you can buy a tree, and you can decorate it with your brand. So if it's, say, it's Domino's Pizza, well, this whole tree will be filled with little pizzas and stuff like that.
Okay.
If it's the housing company, like KB Homes, it'll be little houses on this tree. So it's a nice way to advertise your company and celebrate Christmas.
Sure.
And then each tree is rated between $600 to $2,500 a tree, depending on the size, and put money, you buy the tree for the season, which is about 6 or 8 weeks, and that money goes directly to Opportunity Village to help the kids, and then you get a tree to decorate and kind of advertise your brand or your Penn and Teller have one. So anyways, this morning I'm going to go down there with Lefty and Chloe, and we're going to decorate the tree for 3 hours, and Lefty's got his little orange hats because that's his signature. Chloe's got her pink shoes because she's known for wearing pink, and of course I've made these little stick figures with a little circle with pipe cleaner hair that's yellow with black glasses, and these are our decorations, and I have a train running around the bottom of it because obviously I managed a train,
right.
And then the star on the top of the tree is going to be a black top hat with a rabbit that goes in and out of it. So we're decorating that today because the park opens Friday. And then after that, Chloe's got a meeting with a publicist. Lefty's got a meeting with, because he consults. That's his other job, his day job. He consults on shows, so he's consulting with a producer. And then at 1 o'clock, I have a meeting with a magazine in town in regards to ads that I'm going to put out in December. And then literally, I'll come home. I'll pack my suitcase around 2:30. And 3:30, I have a radio interview. I'm going to be on the radio from 3:30 to 4 o'clock with called the Rockin' Comedy Show. So I'm going to be doing that till 4 o'clock. And then literally, I'll hop in my car, drive to L.A., with Lefty. I'm going to be in L.A. about 9:30 at night. I'll probably go to the Magic Castle for a quick drink, throw my tie on, and go to the castle around 10 o'clock tonight in L.A., have a drink, and see a few friends.
Yeah.
And then at 9 a.m., I'm on the set, which will be Thursday, shooting Hallmark's Home and Family, and I'll be blocking rehearsing from 9 to, like, 1 o'clock, and then we go live across the nation from 1 to 3 o'clock on Hallmark's Home and Family. So that's my next 20 hours.
Wow, that's... That's a lot more than some people do in a month.
Sure. So, and then I come back to Vegas, and we, you know, we do more interviews like this with lovely people like yourself.
And, yeah. And so that's why you're the celebrity magician, because people,
maybe
you know,
that's why.
That kind of keeps your face out in front of everybody. And I think that's what you have to be as a shark. You have to keep moving all the time, you know, because
and the key is I love what I do. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is important. Well, as we leave then, of course, this is called a magic word. And let me ask you, what is important? What is your magic word or your phrase?
I think the magic word or the phrase, I mean, my magic phrase always is don't fool them, entertain them. And I've lived by that. It's on the back of my coffee mug. And also my second thing, my word of the day or my phrase of the day is, you know, do as many charities as you can. You know, we're given this opportunity, and you can call it blessed or faith or whatever you choose, that we're given this great gift of entertainment like you do with magic. And of course, I know you had also a corporate background, of course, with the oil companies and that, but we have this gift of performing. And when you have that gift, the beautiful thing is to give back. And when you're in the public eye, yes, we get those beautiful corporate jobs that we can pay our bills with and buy nice gifts for our friends and our family with, but there's also that side where charities you can do, which I do charities all the time, like Opportunity Village, and don't ever underestimate the power of your talent mixing with the charity, because that's, to me, the power of being an entertainer. Not the money, it's the power of, you know, helping people out with the talent you have. So
that's true. You know, whenever you say don't fool them, entertain them, I can hear Marvin Roy saying that. You must have learned that, obviously, from him.
I learned that from everybody.
I can hear him saying that. And I certainly agree with you in giving back, you know, that Michael Finney and Steve Bragazzi had gotten me connected with the Wounded Warriors, and I've been doing, you know, some things for them, and I think that it is important to give back. You know, there are so many good and valid charity organizations, and a lot of times people say, well, I don't need the exposure, I'm not going to do something for free. Well, I think you can be selective as to what you decide that you want to give your time, because you're right, we have been given a special gift of being able to entertain. Not everybody can do that. There are only a few thousand of us around the world, and so we could and should be selective as to what we actually want to support. But I would go along with you, Murray, and try to encourage others to select those, particularly now we're getting into the holiday season, and there might be some opportunity for you to go into a hospital, you know, and entertain youth or some sort of an organization that you can support and offer your services.
And it makes you feel, I mean, when you leave, it makes you feel phenomenal.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
People understand that. Sure, there's those charity shows where you go, oh my God, here we go. Or there's an organizer that just doesn't know what they're doing, and they really don't.
Right.
And they take you for granted because you're not getting paid. But you got to look past them and then see that audience. I mean, just two examples, and I know you got to run, but is we did one for Children of the Night in L.A., and Children of the Night are these kids, and it floors me that it's happening, but in our country especially. But, you know, kids from age 9 to 18 that are being used for prostitution in L.A., I mean, they're just foster kids or abandoned. Mm. And you know, they get picked up on Facebook or Craigslist or all this stuff, and they're used for prostitution. And then they're stuck in this world they don't know how to get out of.
Yeah.
And then it's called Children of the Night, and the government has not identified with this organization, because if you identify with the organization, you'll have to identify with the problem. And that's not an opinion, it's just they've not so basically it's all privately funded. The government will not fund it. So this woman who's phenomenal runs Children of the Night. So at the Magic Castle, they said, my publicist, Cheryl Kagan, said, hey, do you mind bringing the kids in for an afternoon? I said, great. So I called them. I said, hey, a brunch. Can we bring these kids in? I really want to do this. You know, let's load it up. So we brought like 30 of them in, and I said, I'm going to give them DVDs and everything, and they're all going to get DVDs, see my show, sit in the front row. And they came in, and we did the show. And I actually had to do an extra show that day because the kids bumped to another show, because, you know, when you do castle shows, sometimes you get two in the afternoon, three,
right,
whatever. We bumped it to three because the kids all came in and filled the theater. And at the end, I sat there and chatted with them. And it was really hard for me not to be emotional, because I'm sitting there and these kids are dressed in their best looking like church dresses and little suits and ties. And they're all sitting there. Every single one of them has been in the world of prostitution. Mm. And I'm looking at these kids, and it just, those two don't work for me. I had such a hard time getting a grasp on this in my head.
Wrapping your head around it, right.
Oh, and they were so sweet, so generous, so pleasant, so well-mannered. And you're looking at this going, man, thank God for this woman, because in the next 10 years, hopefully they can look in the past and be a keynote speaker, or be someone that shares that horrible experience with kids who are going to be maybe in their position, unfortunately, and make it better. But when you sit there and do that, you go, I couldn't have paid enough to be a part of that. I'd want to pay to be a part, to get that opportunity to perform for these kids, because maybe I can change one of their lives by doing what I do, going, look, you don't have to be a lawyer or a doctor. You don't need to be that intelligent to make it in this world. Yes, that helps, and you can invent the computer or email or something that's amazing in the world. You can also do something you love doing. Be an artist. Be a dog walker. Be a babysitter. Be a professional nanny. Whatever you want to do in your life. So anyways, in that sense, it's one of those things where I sit back and go, it's so important that, you know, you do these charities because you sit back and go, wow, when that show ended, it was, you know, me and Chloe and Doug just kind of reset for the next show. We didn't even talk to each other because I think we were so taken back by the fact that, you know, wow, you know, that could be anyone's kid, you know. So, yeah, these charities are really important.
Yep. Well, Murray, thank you very much. Good advice and everything. And I appreciate the time that you had here this morning. And, and also your magic words and sharing all of that. So have a great time over Christmas. And also when you open on the 20th, if people want to follow you, where can they get hold of you as far as
following on Twitter? Twitter is my full name, Murray Sawchuck, S-A-W-C-H-U-C-K. You can find me on Facebook. Just Google Murray or Murray Celebrity Magician. My website's murraymagic.com. So all that stuff will come up. And I want to thank you, Scott. You know, we've been friends for a long time. You know, you're like, you're like a second father to me or an uncle I never had. So thank you for being a good friend. And thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you. I certainly appreciate it. And so for the magic word, that was Murray Sawchuck. My boy.
Thank you.
You bet. Scotty out. Thanks for listening to this podcast, and thank you, Murray, for your time and advice. If you happen to be in Las Vegas, be sure to check out Murray's new show at Planet Hollywood and tell him that you heard him here on this podcast. And don't forget, there is one more week left for you to enter the contest to win a free DVD of Lotto Fever by Jamie Salinas. If you'd like to see a full demo presentation of Lotto Fever, then visit www.lottofever.magicbyjamie.com to see a video and read more about this fantastic one-person prediction effect. And as a reminder, to enter the contest, all you have to do is visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/themagicwordpodcast and post a new thread. You can talk about past podcasts you've enjoyed, suggest a person that you'd like to hear me interview, how you think the magic word can be improved, or basically about anything you want to post. I will draw one name from those who have posted and announce the winner in next week's podcast, December 18th. Your odds are pretty good because as of this week, there have been less than a half dozen people who have posted anything since I announced the contest last week. But even if you don't win the contest, you can get a great deal on Lotto Fever 2.0 through our website. For a limited time, meaning now through next week, December 18th, you can get a discount on Lotto Fever 2.0 through themagicwordpodcast.com. Just click on the banner on the blog or go directly to my store through our website. You can order using a credit card or PayPal. I appreciate your support and look forward to having you back here next week with an all-new podcast. Until then, this is Scotty out.